Okay, we're going to get started. We may have some later arrivals, but I hope that you'll bear with me since there is no physical barrier between our room and the room next door. So I'll just try to project the best I can, and if you have any problems hearing me, just raise your hand and let me know. So this is a... I modified the title for my PowerPoint slide, but this is the breakout session that is how to identify and resolve dissociation for clients with trauma with dynamic energetic healing. So before we start, what I'd like to do first of all is... share the experience with you all of balancing our energy fields a little bit. It being Sunday morning, and probably because you haven't had the time to do your daily qigong or meditation or anything. So what I'd like, just a few basic exercises. First, starting by a thymus thump. As you probably know, Dr. John Diamond was a strong proponent of the thymus thump. He may have been the one that actually developed it and incorporated it into the energy psychology paradigm. He had a strong belief from his own empirical research that stimulating the thymus like this actually brought together all the, or brings together all of the acupuncture meridians in the meridian system. So he would often just use this intervention for balancing if he could not muscle test somebody. So we'll do this for another 10 seconds. Okay, next, stimulate those points under your collarbones. These are the 27th points along the kidney meridians. Good morning. This is to help our systems wake up a little bit. Good. And lastly, I'd like to have you stimulate the endpoints of the governing vessel here and the central vessel here to balance those two midline channels. Those that interact with our environment. Okay, and as you'll discover, this presentation is an exploration in consciousness. So before we start, it's very important that we set the space or create a sacred space, a safe space in here. So the way that we do that is just to take 30 seconds or so to call in your own spiritual resources, whomever or whatever that may be. Good morning. And whether it's your higher power or a place in nature where you go to, or you're helping spirits. Good morning. Just ask them to be here to support you and the work that's done so that there's good energetic integrity and spiritual safety for whatever follows for the next hour and 45 minutes. Just 30, 45 seconds. Thank you. Okay, thank you. So, there was no whiteboard for me to write down my objectives, so what I'm going to do is just let you know what my intentions are for today's presentation. I'm going to talk about dissociation, and first, from a Western psychological point of view, what we know about it since Sigmund Freud in 1900 to present. I am then going to talk about dissociation from a shamanic paradigm that is referred to as soul loss. So I'm going to be going back and forth in the terminology, because essentially they're the same things, but there are distinctive differences. So, after I explain the difference between the Western and the Eastern or shamanic paradigm for how they deal with dissociation, I'm then going to explain a little bit about the shamanic paradigm, and then I'm going to explain my embodiment protocol, which is a way to actually identify through muscle testing in an energy psychology model called dynamic energetic healing, or DEH, how to actually calibrate or determine the degree to which somebody is dissociated, and then help them to restore full embodiment and be able to support them afterwards to ensure that once you as the facilitator have helped them to restore full embodiment, that they're able to learn to stay in their body. So, that's the general outline. After giving you a conceptual map, I will have at least one demonstration. If there's time, I'll have two. And that way you'll get to see how I work and how this model works. And then afterwards, if you have any questions, hopefully we'll have time for that, and or it can follow out into the lobby afterwards. So, where to start? I'll tell you just a little bit about myself briefly and how I got to this place. I've been a student and practitioner of core shamanic practices since 1981, so it's almost been three decades. I had the great good fortune of having a good friend of mine mentor me for the first 8 years. At that time, I didn't do any healing work for anybody else. We just met every other week, and Michelle, my friend, was one of the very first certified students from Michael Harner. He's an anthropologist who brought in shamanism to the West around 1980 with the publication of his book, The Way of the Shaman. So he has since developed the Foundation for Shamanic Studies and now trains people throughout the United States and Europe in how to do that, and he trains teachers to teach that. So, during those years, we just basically exchanged. She would teach me shamanic journey method, and I would teach her what I was learning at the time. I was learning early on in my career Ericksonian hypnosis, and so I was studying with Stephen Gilligan and Jay Haley and some of those people who were affiliated with the Milton H. Erickson Institute in Phoenix. And it was during the time that I was studying with Gilligan that I discovered that actually I had a tendency to dissociate. So in the hypnotic exercises I was doing, this was a great revelation to me. Because as you know, hypnosis is an intentional therapeutic dissociation process where you're working with your client to get them into a therapeutic trance. so that their conscious and unconscious mind are dissociated, as you can intersperse suggestions to directly into the unconscious. So I was doing that for a number of years, and then it occurred to me that this was becoming a much more cerebral kind of orientation than I was really wanting. I was learning how to make elaborate stories with multiple embedded metaphors, interspersing suggestions in the stories. I mean, it was very fun intellectually, but I have to say that as my client was laying on the recliner in this very deeply relaxed state, I was involved in all this kind of creative thinking to be able to support them to reassociate at the unconscious level. And it wasn't as much fun for me. It was intellectually challenging, but I knew I needed something more. So at that time, I heard Michael Toms interviewing a man named Dr. Arnold Mandel on New Dimensions Radio. And I thought, I've got to study with this guy. But at the time, Arnold Mandel was training and living in Zurich, Switzerland. Arnold Mandel, for those of you who may not know, first was a physicist. Then he moved over to Jungian psychology. Eventually, he became a training analyst for the Jung Institute in Zurich and spent about 20 years doing that until he became bored analyzing people's dreams, according to his own admission. So he started to move away from the Jung Institute and developed his own process that incorporated the body. Initially, he called this dream body work, but it shortly progressed into process-oriented psychology or process work. It was also my good fortune that his first international intensive was at Merrillhurst University in Lake Oswego, about 45 minutes from where I live in Salem, Oregon. So I couldn't believe it. I was a member of the Jung Institute, the Portland chapter, so I would attend these meetings, and then I got a postcard a couple months after I heard that interview that he and his training staff were going to Lake Oswego for an introduction. So I took the weekend training, introductory training, loved it, put my life on hold, and then jumped into the one-month intensive, which taught me about how to incorporate my body into the therapy element that I had never been trained to do at all. You know, it was all talk therapy and interviewing and then the hypnosis, which was actually very mental. So from that point forward, I spent about 2 years facilitating a peer process group, and then I spent the next 10 years or the next eight years facilitating a process-oriented therapy group with adults. It was a mixed group, men and women, every Tuesday night for about 2 hours, and I just had a great and wild time because in this methodology, we would be externalizing every inner split with a great deal of psychodrama and yelling and wrestling. I mean, we just went with this principle of amplification and intensified or amplified anything that was happening. And I thought, this is what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my therapeutic career. It was wonderful. I reconnected to my body. I stopped dissociating. I got more grounded. And it was very exciting. And then my colleague, Mary Hammond, who had just taken her first thought field therapy course, told me about that. So she said, oh, you got to take this. So I did, and then she and I and another colleague started moving into our energy psychology trainings. So I should say from the start that Mary Hammond and I are the co-developers of dynamic energetic healing, or DEH as I'll refer to it. And initially, we started our trainings together. We co-trained for a number of years, and we started our beginning manuals. And then after a few years, we stopped so that we could begin respectively writing our own books. So my book came out in 2006. Her book came out last year. And in that interim, as I was writing my book, it became clear to me that because of my shamanic background, I actually felt more comfortable, and Mary felt this way too, doing our separate trainings within the DEH model, which is an energy psychology-based model with muscle testing and energy psychology interventions and so on. So I have integrated the shamanic paradigm into my DEH work, and that's primarily what differentiates the way that we work together. I mean, the way that we work in the DEH model. So, from a Western psychological model, dissociation is something that Freud brought to our awareness as one of many defense mechanisms. I'm sorry, it just occurred to me that I have handouts for you that are actually the PowerPoint presentation. So that way you can make your notes right on that. So, yeah, you're welcome. So why don't you pass those around? If you're short, I have more. Well, then it shouldn't be a problem. And so as a defense mechanism, one of many, it's an unconscious adaptive strategy to deal with an overwhelming life experience or trauma. And what Freud has taught us is that the therapist's job is to integrate that part that dissociated. Need some more?
Yes, five more.
Thank you, David. Through a number of different therapeutic strategies to integrate that part that has dissociated into the core personality. And this is done variously through all kinds or through a variety of modalities, all of which intend to create the same outcome, integration. So these are double-sided, by the way. So this would include hypnosis, which is to help the person at the unconscious level integrate the split-off part or the part that's dissociated as a consequence of trauma. This is done through depth psychology, through symbolic imagery, and dream analysis work. Psychoanalysis that isn't quite as popular anymore because of the length of time and because of insurance companies. However, I would say that traditional cognitive behavioral talk therapy does tend to try to accomplish the same thing through a period of time, through insight and discussion to actually generate awareness about what happened traumatically so that that part that got split off in the trauma can actually come back into the sphere of conscious awareness. And then there are other models, of course. Probably many of you have used voice dialogue, gestalt empty chair work, and so on. So just from the very start, I want to emphasize that Western psychological therapy methods have for a long time been working toward the end of reintegrating parts that have dissociated, that Freud was aware of as one of many defense mechanisms. Now, I want to say something else about trauma and dissociation. It's my belief in talking, this is outside of the energy psychology world. Let me preface it that way, because in our energy psychology community, PTSD is well known. It's part of our training to become more familiar with so that we can address the effects of trauma effectively. And PTSD is an example of severe trauma that's happened usually over a period of time. Typically, the subjective time period is that if a person has not resolved their own traumatic experience from whatever the trauma was after a period of 6 months through medication, through brief therapy, through consultation and support by friends, through just time, if symptoms persist beyond 6 months, then it falls within that diagnostic category of PTSD. So it's been my experience, and it is my belief, that many therapists who are not trained within the energy psychology world actually underrepresent PTSD as a diagnostic category. That's because they've never been probably sufficiently taught the depth or extent of that, and it's because the tendency of most Americans, and maybe this is true for other nationalities too, is that when there are PTSD symptoms such as anxiety or insomnia or panic attacks or despair and depression or feeling suicidal, frequently the first stop is the family doctor. And the family doctor will tend to prescribe medication to modify the brain biochemistry to create these changes to stabilize that person. If the person's lucky and it doesn't work, the medication doesn't work well enough, then through a friend or through actually a referral from that unusual doctor who may refer to a psychologist or a therapist, they'll get into somebody to be able to work on what they experienced as a consequence of trauma to try to get to the roots of it. But that tends to be the Western protocol. And so consequently, many therapists are being given a diagnostic label from the doctor that this person came in for anxiety. Or the client will say, I have anxiety because this is what the doctor said. Or I have depression and I have Prozac, and so this is what the doctor said, so this is what I have. So talk therapists will frequently go to that diagnosis and treat that. Even if they take a good comprehensive history, they often will overlook the depth of the residual trauma that actually represents PTSD. So PTSD often is not represented amongst talk therapists. There are a couple of people who just came in, so if you can pass that out, thank you. Okay, so that's a Western psychological approach. There are also ways that people have gone to seek this out themselves for dealing with trauma and self-healing to try to address their own dissociation, meditation, personal growth seminars, different spiritual paths, body work. These are all ways that people will seek out if they have a feeling or a sense that something isn't right. And so I would say that they all work to varying degrees. However, it's also been my experience. When I was younger, I was affiliated with the American Sikh community when I was very much into Kundalini yoga and meditation. And our teacher at that time, Yogi Bhajan, would continue to exhort us to meditate more often, 25 hours a day in the 24-hour day, as the cure, along with lots of Kundalini yoga, to resolve anything that was going on mentally with us or emotionally. But there was really never any suggestion of psychotherapy. It was always basically working on the upper chakras, the heart center, the throat center, third eye point, and crown chakra to generate spiritual connectedness. Lower triangle, the first three chakras, were often completely disregarded. Not always, but usually. So nobody in that community was into or was doing or seeking out any kind of psychotherapy because this methodology had it all according to our teacher. And I don't think that's unusual. So there was a lot of dysfunction in the community because people weren't working on their family of origin material as they were projecting onto each other in the community hierarchy, as often happens in those kinds of situations. Serial relationships is another way that people tend to work on trying to heal and correct split-off parts. And most of you probably know this, as we may reenact those child-parent relationships by projecting onto somebody the parts that we've disavowed, seeing it in somebody else, going out there to deal with it in a relationship that becomes very painful, rather than going inside and dealing with it internally. So there are various permutations of this, but they frequently end up with a great deal of difficulty. So, having said that, as a very brief overview of Western approaches to dealing with dissociation, I want to talk about how the shamanic paradigm discusses essentially the same thing, but with some distinctions. The definition of dissociation is called soul loss in the shamanic paradigm. It's when part of our vital essence separates from our core self to survive an overwhelming life experience, what Bessel van der Kolk refers to as trauma, an overwhelming life experience. So, in the shamanic paradigm, in about 95% of shamanic teachings cross-culturally, it is a tripartite universe. This comes from Michael Harner's anthropological research about what he calls core shamanic practices. So, in this tripartite universe, we coexist with spirits or spiritual beings in what is referred to as this middle world. Then there is the upper world and the lower world. In the upper world and the lower world, these are realms outside of time where the beings that one might meet, whether they're power animals or human-formed, anthropomorphized beings, in the lower world or upper world, are purely compassionate. They are there to help alleviate pain and suffering. And so through the shamanic journey method that is generated through percussive drive, rattling or drumming or click sticks, a change in our consciousness occurs and we can move into that so-called shamanic state of consciousness and travel or journey to connect with a spiritual teacher in this other realm, a guide, a power animal, a guardian spirit that can help us in our work with our clients. However, as I said, for the first 8 years of my training, I never worked with anybody else. I was just learning the various skill sets of the shaman, which include, among other things, of course, the shamanic journey, which is fundamental, how to connect with and bond with and trust spiritual teachers or guides in the lower world or upper world, how to do soul retrievals, how to extract negative or dark energies from people, things that are in the body that shouldn't be in the body or in the energy field, how to support people as they're passing over, that's called psychopomp work, how to practice divination and diagnostic skills. I should say also that all of these that fit within the skill set of the shaman are done through the agency of the helping spirit. So I can say that it's true over many years I've collected a large group of helping spirits, compassionate spirits, but it's only through them in the journey that this information is actually accessed. I consider myself to be always just along for the ride. So whether it's a power animal or an upper world teacher, it is that being that can tell me about what's going on in a person or read their energy field, or it's that being that pulls out the negative energy. Yes?
Do you choose consciously if you go to the upper world or the lower world, and how do you know where you are?
So the question is, do I choose consciously to go to the upper world or the lower world, and how do I know where I am? Well, sometimes I intentionally choose to go to the upper world because that's where a particular spirit teacher resides.
What's the difference?
Well, the difference is that the lower world tends to be in the landscapes. It tends to be more earthy, although there's no absolute rule about this. In the upper world, it tends to be more ethereal. And so while the literature will say that in the lower world there tend to be more power animals that you would look for, there are also power animals that you will find in the upper world. And so it's also said that in the upper world you will find the souls of the great teachers, the great ascended masters. And it is also true that I have been led to human form teachers in the lower world. These are not rigid rules. But after a while, let me back up. So in my training, I train my trainees in a very abbreviated manner how to do the shamanic journey, how to go down into the lower world and find and connect to a power animal, and then eventually how to move up to the upper world and find a human form teacher. And so now when I journey, if I know a power animal resides in the lower world, that's where I will intend. If I know a particular upper world Tibetan master is in a particular place in the upper world realm, that's where I'll go. But sometimes, after a while, after some experience, what happens is the teachers come to me, or the power animals come to me while I'm working in the psychotherapy context, and each one of them has a particular specialty. So one of my power animals is used specifically for soul retrievals. That's all that this animal does. Another one is used for transmuting darker negative energy and pulling it out of the body. Another one, an upper world teacher, specifically turns this upper world Tibetan master that I perceive and directs a certain vibrational chanting to a person and repairs the tears in their energy field, and on and on. So over a period of time, shamanic practitioners collect helpers that support them in very specific tasks. I also want to say that it would be imprudent for me to say I am a shaman, because these days, since Michael Harner has brought shamanism back to the West, and there are other teachers also, Alberto Villoldo teaches a form of shamanism from the Incan tradition, and there are Mayan teachers. There are a lot of teachers who are bringing their knowledge forth now. In indigenous societies, shamans still are important because they are the healer and the spiritual advisor for that community. But because of the way that we live in this 21st century, it would, I believe, be presumptuous to say that we as shamanic practitioners are shamans, because we don't service a community the way that indigenous societies have their shamans service the community. So I can rightly say I'm a shamanic practitioner, but I don't feel comfortable saying that I'm a shaman, regardless of how many years that I've been practicing. So
Have you had an initiatory experience on your own?
I've had many.
Yeah.
And I've studied with a number of teachers also. I mean, human teachers along the way. So I've studied Celtic shamanism with Tom Cowan, and I've studied Hawaiian shamanism with Hank Wesselman, and I've studied with Sandra Ingerman, and Michael Harner has a three-year program where he provides advanced shamanic initiations that he's learned from being with indigenous people. And the spirits themselves are, through their own compassion, very ready when you're willing to initiate you into another level of experience. That's always a surprise. Now, one thing I want to say about middle world work, this being the middle world where we cohabitate with other spiritual energies or other spiritual beings, one of the consequences of being dissociated is that if we're out of our body for any length of time, that I've discovered happens quite frequently as a consequence of trauma, as a piece of traumatic residue. As you know, nature abhors a vacuum. And so if a person is chronically dissociated, then anything that's in the field can avail itself to occupy that space where that person had been full. And so this is referred to, although it sounds pretty weird, this is referred to in the shamanic paradigm as possession illness, because it is well known among shamanic practitioners that in this middle world realm, spirits of the deceased don't always make it over to the next place, into the light, to continue their evolution. So consequently, if we're vulnerable, if we've gone through trauma, if our boundaries are down, if we've dissociated, then we're vulnerable to these beings that are all around us because they lost their way to attach to us. And I see that frequently with clients from all kinds of different circumstances. And there really ought to be only one soul in this body. And if there is another soul being that has attached, well, then the consequences to that can be very difficult. That is possession illness. And a person's life force can start to feel compromised. A person can generate all kinds of symptoms and so on. And so I'll tell you a few case histories about that in a little while. But anyway, it's... For those who are uninitiated in the shamanic paradigm, it may sound occult or otherworldly, but the analogy I make is that it's not that different from actually us being in relationship to microbes. They're invisible. Scientists and doctors tell us they're all over our hands, they're all over the keyboards. When you go into a hotel, they're all over the remote control and doorknobs and so on. But we don't see them because they live in this invisible realm. So we're told to wash our hands frequently when the swine flu has, you know, come in onto the scene, a new virus. But we don't see that. But if we keep our resistance up and we get good sleep and we're mentally and emotionally and spiritually well, we're not going to fall prey to these viruses or these bacteria, even if other people around us are getting ill. I don't know about you, but I have a few clients who come in frequently and they've picked it up, whatever it is at the time, and they tell me, oh, it's going around, everybody's got this flu virus, and I never hear about it. But these people are always sick. And it's the same kind of thing with this other dimension that we call the shamanic paradigm, where in this middle world there are beings, these earthbound spirits that are trapped. They're disoriented and they're frightened. They're not malevolent. It's not like you may have heard about or seen in sensationalized Hollywood movies. It's just that these beings somehow miss the boat or they miss their transition, and so they're wandering. And so they're frightened and they're disoriented. They think they're dead, but they're not quite sure. They're usually looking for loved ones. And so if we're vulnerable, they'll attach to our energy field, or they will attach to a chakra or to our body somehow. And then there are complications that happen as a consequence. And because I'm sensitive to that realm, I actually encounter that quite often in my practice. So let's continue. So Western psychologists do know about dissociation. This is not new. It's widely written in the literature from trauma, whether it's a single incident trauma like an assault or a car accident, and people will report having seen themselves being cut out of the car by the paramedics, the jaws of life as they're hovering above, or from somebody who's experienced ongoing persistent trauma, whether they were molested or whether they were abused or beaten up in some way as a child over many years, and seeing themselves on the ceiling, looking down on the event. There's lots of evidence in the literature about this. So this is not new information. But what I believe from my experience is that once I discovered in my hypnosis trainings that I was in fact dissociated, and I had not known that, that was semi-chronic, I worked on that in the hypnotic process. I got more solid when I was doing process work, since it involved the body so much. And since my energy psychology trainings began in 1997, and I started integrating the shamanic piece into my work with people, it's occurred to me that more people that I see who come in for treatment have various degrees of post-traumatic stress because it's lasted longer than 6 months, PTSD, and though there are many aspects of PTSD, as you know, from persistent limiting beliefs to negative emotional charge, such as relentless shame or out-of-proportion anger, physical symptoms such as fibromyalgia and migraine headaches and chronic fatigue. You know, there are also the psychic components like flashbacks and dissociation. So I don't mean to just say there's only dissociation as a consequence of trauma. But having said that, what I've discovered is that so many of my clients come in who have experienced post-traumatic stress and thus need treatment for their depression or their anxiety or some of the physical symptoms that accompany their panic attacks. And to my great surprise, at least initially, they were dissociated. So initially I discovered this because in the interactive process, I just noticed that they were kind of floating. A part of them was floating above their head. I could just perceive this, kind of hovering. And so I muscle tested this and discovered that, in fact, this person was not 100% present in their physical body. So over a period of a number of years of continuing to muscle test and corroborate this, along with the symptoms that these people were reporting to me, I developed this embodiment protocol. So I want to read a few quotes by Eliade about the soul, and then we'll move on. I still have a few more of these handouts. I noticed a few people came in even later, so... everything that concerns the soul and its adventure here on earth and in the beyond is the exclusive province of the shaman. Through his own pre-initiatory and initiatory experience, he knows the drama of the human soul, its instability, its precariousness. In addition, he knows the forces that threaten it and the regions to which it can be carried away. So, anthropologists who've studied shamans know about this. Some common symptoms of soul loss, and this would also be relevant to an individual who's been chronically dissociated include lack of physical energy, lack of connectedness, anhedonia, which is the inability to experience pleasure, spiritual emptiness, a disconnection between the body and the self, depersonalization, and these are all different aspects that are reported to me by clients. Not all of them all the time, but many of them most of the time. Difficulty concentrating and remembering, flattened affect, physical numbness, feeling dead or empty inside, along with anxiety, panic attacks, and other symptoms. If you have somebody that's telling you they're studying for a test, they have test anxiety, they keep reading the same paragraph over and over again, but they can't retain the information, there's a high likelihood that they're dissociated. So in your history, ask about what other physical symptoms they're experiencing. Because in my experience, although many of these symptoms that I've just described come with the diagnosis of being dissociated, partially dissociated to some degree, it's also true that there are frequently physical symptoms such as, well, there's one man that's come in for a couple of years until we cleared out all the trauma in the background, and he would come in knowing he was dissociated with fierce pressure against his chest. This is not uncommon to panic disorder. Feeling like his heart rate was elevated, palpitations. He felt pressure against his arms and his mid-back. He would have insomnia and occasionally very powerful headaches along with inability to concentrate and focus. So as soon as we get through the protocol and he's fully back present in his body, he starts yawning in the process as he's releasing whatever it was, coming back into balance. All of his symptoms, I mean all of his symptoms, dissipate right away. And I have this... Now, when somebody comes in for the first or second time, their recognition of their symptom dissolution is not quite as immediate. They all report feeling better right away. But after a while, after they've been in the process a few times and they notice the difference between feeling fully present back in their physical body in contrast to feeling dissociated or checked out, and they're able to differentiate perceptually how it feels, they notice that things are much more crisp in their perception. And their enjoyment of sensory-based experience is tremendously enhanced. They can think again more clearly and so on. So as you become more alert to this, you might want to wonder, what is this about this individual? Would this be dissociation? Gene Achterbird, quote, "Soul loss is regarded as the gravest diagnosis in the shamanic nomenclature, being seen as a cause of illness and death, yet it is not referred to at all in modern Western medical books. Nevertheless, it is becoming increasingly clear that what the shaman refers to as soul loss, that is, injury to the inviolate core that is the essence of the person's being, does manifest in despair, immunological damage, cancer, and a host of other very serious disorders." So, my contention is, if you notice somebody is dissociated, and if it's been chronic, and if it's not corrected, then these symptoms are going to get worse and worse. This gentleman I was referring to would frequently go to the doctor because he was sure that he had something wrong with his heart. There was never anything medically wrong with him. And this happens frequently when people have these symptoms from being dissociated. He'd come back in fact, he and another client, after he identified, or we identified, the traumatic residue or the stimulus response that was recreating the dissociative response, I would tell him and another client, come in anytime, just give me a call. It takes 5 to 10 minutes. I'll chime my Tibetan bell or I'll do whatever and help you to get back into your body. I won't charge you for the appointment, and you'll be on your way until your next appointment. Because they could tell. My clients learn to notice the difference between how it is to be in their body and when they're, quote, messed up.
Howard?
Yes.
Do you really need shamanic kind of treatments, or can you just by tapping help the people to get in their own body, or do they can do it themselves with tapping or kind of treatments?
Okay, so the question is, do you really need shamanic treatments to help somebody regain full embodiment? And the answer is no, you don't need shamanic skills. You're just two slides ahead of me.
I'm sorry.
But it must be that precognitive ability that you're picking up. Where is the dissociated part? In Western psychology, we refer to it as being somewhere in the unconscious. It's interesting where that is, but it's that area within us that's below the level of our conscious awareness. In shamanism, it would be where is the dissociated part? The part that experiences, we who experience soul loss have lost that part that has gone to non-ordinary reality, that other realm, somewhere in the upper world or the lower world or the middle world. And in dynamic energetic healing, I would say that the split-off part could be in the unconscious, it could be in non-ordinary reality, and it could be in our energy field. So, for the shaman, it is not necessary to dialogue with the client and actually find out very much, because the shaman recruits his or her helping spirits who know where the lost soul part is and who actually go after it and bring it back. And that's called a soul retrieval. So my dilemma. Clients come in for therapy. They want a positive and rapid therapeutic result or results within a Western psychological counseling, a therapeutic framework. Okay? They don't want shamanic rituals. Neither do insurance companies. They don't want the rattling and the drumming and the burning of the sage and all that. It would definitely be a rapport buster to do that on a regular basis. If somebody wants shamanic work, then I put on a different hat and we're not doing any counseling anymore. We're doing shamanic healing. So the truth is, most of the DEH practitioners that I train, even though they have a very modest introduction to shamanism, are not shamanic practitioners. So I wanted to make this available to anybody in the energy psychology community, so that you needn't be a shaman, although if you have that skill, that's great. So I developed this protocol. I call it the embodiment protocol. It fits into any energy psychology framework that you use, providing you use muscle testing. And my trainees can learn how to use it, as can you. And clients then are able to give me ongoing feedback, or the therapist, as they become increasingly more connected to their physical body. So, with this embodiment protocol, you can learn to track dissociation, as can your client, from the beginning stages to how they're able to stay in their body longer and longer and longer stretches of time before they check out again, and then they'll know if they've dissociated because all their symptoms will return. In this process, clients learn how to orient to their body. And that's very important, because the body is frequently disregarded in psychotherapy. It's always talk therapy or what is the insight that this derives. Since emotions are body-based, clients have more information with which to negotiate our normal reality, because when you're feeling something, you've got much more information for being able to know what to do. But if you're dissociated, you're going to be, to varying degrees, separated from your emotions. Now, it is paradoxical, because when people are dissociated, because they are avoiding a lot of pain, they might say to me, but what's the point? I'm going through this enormous loss, and if I'm back in my body, then it's likely I'm going to feel all this, and then I might be overwhelmed. And so I have to explain to them the possible consequences of continuing to be dissociated with all these potential physical problems, spiritual problems, mental, emotional problems. The truth is, when you're back fully present in your physical body, you have all of your resources available to better deal with and cope with any problem that you have. And then, as an energy psychology practitioner, if you can support that client with learning how to establish proper energetic boundaries with whatever is the offending individual, or help them to release the trauma that they're dealing with through these energy psychology interventions that you all know, then they needn't worry about the pain of re-traumatizing themselves by coming back into their physical body, because you have strategies and interventions that can support them to discharge a lot of that. So, when a person's embodied, a person's connected to life rather than being only partly present, they can access their vital force more congruently and frequently. It has been my experience over and over again that the symptom complex will dissipate. What the symptoms that they came in with, no matter how onerous, no matter how pervasive, tend to leave. And then people get back into being hopeful again and feeling back in control. If in the shamanic paradigm, we say that one way to avoid contracting subtle negative energies is to be empowered, or to be in your power. And so power is a term that the shamans use to represent not just energy, such as if you're channeling healing energy, but the wisdom and the information that the helping spirits provide, along with substantial vital force to keep us well. So if you're in your power, if you're feeling empowered, you're not going to fall prey to all of these complement of dissociative residue. Okay, so this is the protocol. I'm going to just go through it with you, and then I'm going to ask somebody who's willing to go through a demonstration, and I'll model it for you. What I've learned is that I always start off my sessions by establishing sacred space, setting the space. Even if a person doesn't have any, even if they're not shamanically inclined, of course it doesn't matter. As we did before, at the very beginning of this session, for those of you who came in late, I just had everybody close their eyes and connect to their own spiritual resources to create a safe space to protect us from any outside negative influences, and to bestow upon us the blessings of whatever our spirits or spiritual guides or spiritual resources are. And then I always have people, I test for hydration, I make sure that their energy field is balanced so that they're not energetically switched, so that I can muscle test them. Then I always test for generalized psychoenergetic reversal, every single time with every single client. I want to heal, it's possible for me to heal, I deserve to heal, and so on. Healing in general, it's nonspecific. And then I move into the embodiment protocol. Are you 100% present in your physical body? If they're not, then we move into this. And this is the way I always start sessions because I found it to be so important. This is using muscle testing. If a person is not 100% present in their physical body, then you can use muscle testing to calibrate to what percentage degree they are in their body. So, are you 100% in your body? No. Are you at least 70 or 80%? No. Are you at least 60%? No, and so on. Maybe this person's 45% in their body. Now, what that means is that of the consciousness that needs to be connected to your physical body, only 45% or 50% of your consciousness is fully connected to your physical body. And then I get into a dialogue with them. Some people know why they're dissociated. Other people don't have a clue. But it's important just to dialogue and ask, well, do you have any idea why you might be checked out? Why you might be dissociated? It's not important that you get specific information, but you may. So you ask. Next step, you set the intention for your client to be 100% present in their physical body. And then you check for specific psychoenergetic reversal. It's safe for me to be in my body. It's possible for me, and so on. You want to make sure that there's no sabotage at the reversal level for them to be fully present. And then you make sure that there are no objections from any inner parts to move forward on this intention. And then in my DEH model, I might ask, I will ask with muscle testing, are there any energetic origins, originating events from which this dissociation occurred? Because frequently, as I've said, dissociation is a consequence of trauma. So if there's an underlying trauma, then this will identify it, and then we'll find out what needs to be done. Frequently, once we get to whatever is the underlying trauma, and it may take two or three sessions to complete this, usually the client's two or three primary therapeutic goals have been addressed and often resolved by addressing the dissociation, because this has been a primary component of an underlying trauma that's been generating the symptoms that they've come in with as their presenting problem. So I would say yes. Yes. Question.
It says here, check for general specifics that no, make sure there's no objections from inner parts of the client. If there are, what do you do?
Well, then I address whatever the objection is, identify what the objection is, and then release it through energy psychology methods. So that then I'll ask, are there any other inner objections from any other parts, inner parts? There should be no. This is about congruence. This is also about the risk of moving forward rather than staying in the same place. So I'll demonstrate that as well. That was asking about inner part objections. This is to make sure that all parts of the client are congruent with about moving forward on the intention. And I would add, it's important to stay alert to the influence of any subtle negative energy associated with this, since trauma is frequently associated with dissociation, and it is frequently, as I said before, when a person has been traumatized, a person's boundaries are compromised, and then whatever is in the field, whether they're negative intrusions or earthbound spirits or curses or whatever fits into this category of so-called supernatural interference might be present because the client's been more vulnerable. So I may or may not get to model that. So once your client is fully re-embodied, then you ask via manual muscle testing if there's anything else that your client needs to do on a daily or regular basis in order to maintain full embodiment. So There might be an energy psychology interventions that they need to do. They may need to do EFT every day for 3 minutes. They may need to do thymus thump. They may need to do some grounding visualizations every day. I will ask them, and then we'll discuss that through our dialogue. Another very important piece is that after a person has been restored to full embodiment and they're fully present in their physical body, I ask, through muscle testing, do you have 100% energetic boundaries with your physical body? In other words, are you in good harmony, optimal, appropriate relationship now with your physical body? Frequently, people are not, because frequently people have been chronically dissociated for some time. So they've been disconnected from their body, so they're not in good harmony. They're not connected to their body. I mean, they are now in the moment, but they have not been. So that becomes a follow-up intention to restore good harmony, or good, what I call optimal appropriate relationship, good energetic boundaries with their physical body, so that they can start to feel comfortable being in their skin once again and learn what that's like. And I may need to do that a second or third session, but usually by 2 or 3 sessions, a person has learned what the difference is between being dissociated, what that experientially is like, in contrast to being fully present in their physical body, and being in good harmony or being out of harmony with their body. Question?
Just with this 100% energetic boundaries with their physical body, what practices do you recommend for them to establish 100% physical boundaries?
Okay, so the question was, what practices do I recommend to assist the client to restore 100% energetic boundaries with their physical body? Well, I suppose if you're not using muscle testing, then you can use the SUD scale using EFT, having them with their own subjective impressions determine to what degree they feel in harmony with their physical body, with 10 being the worst and 0 or 1 being a good harmony. You can ascribe to that whatever you like. You can be creative. I happen to use this DEH model that goes through the same process of, are there any objections, are there any psychoenergetic reversals, and so on, until we clear out any interference in the way for a person to be in harmony with their physical body. Question?
Yes. When you do normal energy psychology without being aware about the percentage of embodiment, isn't it like a normal side effect of good trauma release that part that was dissociated related to that trauma will automatically reintegrate with the person? Or is it really necessary to address it so consciously as that you do?
Okay, the question is it a natural byproduct using energy psychology techniques, good energy psychology work, that after you've released trauma, working with a client, that dissociated part would automatically come back into the body, the person's body, as a consequence of trauma resolution? Or do you need to do this separately as I'm reflecting? And I would say sometimes it probably is a beneficial byproduct of the good work that you're doing as comprehensive energy psychologists, that dissociated part will spontaneously return. And depending on the degree of trauma, the pervasiveness of the trauma over a long period of time, it may not spontaneously return, and it may be a persistent symptom. What you would know in terms of feedback is dialoguing with your client and asking them or observing them over the next session or two if their symptoms have dissipated, and asking them specific questions relating to dissociation in order to make that assessment if you're not using the embodiment protocol. So there's no absolute way to know that, but I think good interviewing and good perceptions might be your clue. That's a good question. Thank you. So So sometimes it's also necessary to teach the client some grounding visualizations to establish a firm connection to the earth in order to prevent the recurrence of the problem. That makes sense to you, I'm sure. And I recommend that the client journal each evening to stay conscious of stimulus-response dissociation episodes. So even if the originating trauma or traumas have been cleared or depotentiated, the echo of that trauma might tend to replay in this person's interactions with a supervisor at work who might be a bully, or with a controlling person, or with their spouse, or with a child. Frequently, through the interactions with other individuals, a person can have the dissociative response re-stimulated or triggered once again. So, if they're journaling every night, and this can be very simple, I ask them to agree to write out just a few lines of how they've been feeling during the day, if they've noticed that they had any stressful experiences or interactions, to write down what happened, if anything, and how they're feeling and what they've noticed. So they can track subjectively how their interactions interpersonally has been, and if in fact there have been any stimulus response events that created that response again. This is a way for them to become personally more responsible and more sensitive to their own old habit of dissociating under stress. So then they can bring that into the session the next time, and I can help them by establishing better energetic boundaries with whatever is that person or context that tends to be problematic that re-stimulated that stimulus-response dissociative episode. Okay. Any questions before I give a demonstration? All right. Yes.
What kind of compliance do you get with asking people to journal every night?
Question was, what kind of compliance do I get asking people to journal every night? I get very good compliance because people are strongly motivated to feel better, and the contrast is usually so dramatic after being dissociated. As I explain it to them the way I've explained this to you, I let them know that this is the way that they can take responsibility for feeling better all the time. But they have to be their own detective, in a manner of speaking, to notice when something happens in their day-to-day environment that might set off that old habitual response. So I make it easy. I'm not asking them to write out a whole page, just three or four or five lines, just an abbreviated notation to ask about what their experience was and if there were any events that occurred. Was there a question in the back from anyone? Yes.
I'm going to ask if you have any checklist, is there any possibility of having a checklist that you can give to the clients from which you can determine whether the individual is dissociated? That means that you reduce the amount of questions and answers that you, in the dialogue that you have with the client.
So the question is, do I ever provide a checklist, or do I have a checklist to provide to the client for the various symptoms of dissociation that they can follow, if I get your question right? And I do not, because the symptoms that people experience as a consequence of dissociation is unique to each person. So, of course, they're coming in with presenting problems, and the presenting problems are the symptoms that not always but frequently are a direct consequence of being dissociated. So, whether it's depression or whether it's being anxious from March through July that they attribute to allergies or some e-toxin in the building they're working in, they may not know the reasons, but they know what their symptoms are. So their checklist is the specific symptomatology or symptom complex that they come in with that they're working, that we're working collaboratively to assist them to release. And that's sufficient.
Are you on the phone?
I don't know. I don't know if I'm on that photograph. It's possible.
It's your class when you were young.
Huh?
Is it your class when you were young?
No, it's not my class. At least to my knowledge. But the desks look the same.
Can you be so dissociated that you can be in two persons?
I don't want to go there. Okay, so let's see. This section is over at 9:45, so we have 25 minutes or so for a demonstration. So is there anyone who's interested in... You're interested in being a demo subject? Okay, I saw your hand first. So... Are you willing to sign a release form?
Yes.
Okay. Would you be a good person for this demonstration? Yes. Okay. And I want you to know, though, that you might be, come on up, that you might be disclosing some personal information as a consequence of this. So as long as you're all right with that. Okay, you can read that and print your name and then sign your name mm-hmm. for the release. Now, in this model, I use Tibetan bowls and a Tibetan bell. Everybody loves the vibrational interventions. I use TAT, EFT, NAEM, negative affect erasing method, which is basically tapping these four points that Fred Gallo developed. I call it straight line tapping. I have people tap on the central vessel sometimes, thymus thump, tapping the temporal curve, something called frontal occipital holding, which would be, some of you know what frontal occipital holding is. And it's usually when I do the frontal occipital holding that it only takes a minute or two, but I move into this visionary state. My eyes are open, I just kind of defocus them, and I am able to have these compressed time shamanic journeys for a minute or two where my helpers come to me and do all kinds of healing. And so I should just let you know that once I step in the process with somebody, I have my helpers present, and so I tend to have these movements, these twitches, and make little noises like that. And what I've learned over the years is that when shamanic practitioners are working and they connect to the power of their helping spirits, everybody responds differently. Some people feel the hairs on the back of their neck come up. Some people hear their helping spirits. I have a kinesthetic response and sometimes tend to make a little noise because I feel like my solar plexus is contracting as I hook into their power. So it only happens when I'm working. So if that happens, that's the reason why. So, okay. Are you okay with that?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Okay, so your name is Lynn.
Yes.
Okay. So Lynn, what symptoms would you say might be attributable to being dissociated, if in fact you are? And I don't know that you are or you're not.
Right. Well, I'm thinking particularly under pressure.
Yes.
And I'm pressured to make decisions. I can almost feel myself split off.
Okay.
Yeah. Like a part of my intellectual self will make some decisions, and I mean, even I can even begin to feel it, just even responding to your questions here, because I'm aware of the time pressure. So a part of me it will be very intellectual, but another part will do this other stuff, and I can't pull the two of them together. And so I feel then spacey. And
okay. Yeah. Okay. Are you an energy psychology practitioner?
I'm a beginning energy psychology practitioner.
Okay.
Yes.
So have you ever done muscle testing before?
Yes, I have.
Okay. And do you ever experience other than, this sounds more like situational anxiety, Do you ever experience any other kind of anxiety? Low-level anxiety?
Yeah, I do. I have insomnia.
Okay.
I think I'm much more at night, too.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So I'm going to go through this protocol the way that I would with any client, mm-hmm. And then hopefully we'll have a few minutes for questions. And, you know, every energy psychology person in every model is unique, works uniquely. So I do this muscle testing standing up. And occasionally I have to take notes about what we've done because I tend to kind of move into in and out of these altered states. And sometimes for a minute or so, I kind of lose my tracking for where I am in the moment. So good notes is an important component of this. It's one of the things I teach my trainees. Both of us need to be well hydrated, Lynn. So the hydration test that I learn is with either hand to tug on your hair and put one arm out. Either one. Hold. Wonderful, you're hydrated. Okay. Now let's... I'm going to then sweep in front of you in muscle test and down and up to find out if your energy field is flowing properly. So let me borrow your arms, please. Oh, are you okay with your shoulders
yes.
doing this kind of muscle testing?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, hold. Okay, so this indicates that your energy field is switched. So why don't we both do what we did initially? You can do the thymus thump. Just a reminder, even as the facilitator, I have to be just as balanced and just as hydrated because we are always the weakest link in this energetic field that we're creating. So I always will do whatever balancing exercises that I have my clients do. I'll do this before. If I haven't done my Qigong in the morning, I'll always do balancing exercises, energy balancing exercises before. Now under the collarbones. Okay, and lastly, let's stimulate these two points, governing vessel, central vessel point. Okay, let's try it again, Lynn. Hold. Okay, that balanced your energy. So what that means is that I can rely on your muscle testing to be accurate, which is good. So if during this process you have any questions at all, anything comes up at any time about what I'm doing that you're not understanding, just interject at any time, okay?
Okay.
Let me borrow your arms, please. Hold. So from your inner knowing, is there any generalized psychoenergetic reversal that is present? Wonderful. And are you 100% in your physical body? Okay. Are you at least 70% embodied? 60%? 50%. Strong there, 51. Only 50%. Okay. So, do you have any guesses about why that might be? Of the consciousness that should be present, only 50% is present.
Well, thinking about this particular situation, I know for sure that it was there was a lot in terms of first grade teachers. When I didn't pay attention to that one, but when people pointed out on that, you know,
on the slide,
yeah, and whether there's other originating things with my parents or whatever, who knows?
Okay, so. That's just a little piece of information that may or may not be helpful.
Yeah.
So we're setting an intention now for Lynn to be 100% present in her physical body. and we'll see what happens. Okay, hold on. This intention, is there any specific psychoenergetic reversal? Okay, is there any deception? Okay, good. Are there any inner parts generating objections to move forward on this? Any deception? No. Okay, is there any reason at all not to move forward on this? Okay, does this reflect some kind of an inner conflict? Okay, so we have a pause. Any guesses, any speculations about what might be going on with you about some reason not to move forward on this, to be fully present back in your physical body?
Why? Well, the only thing else I can think about is in terms of my mother was very abusive, and I often blame things on her. And I wondered if my father's expectations, who was my primary parent, whether there's a part of me, you know, feeling like, oh, well, if this is about my dad, then maybe, you know, I blame so much on my mom. So
in other words, you're suggesting that what might come up is that there's been some contributing trauma from your father that before you hadn't really given much energy to or much thought to?
Well, I have done some work on that.
Yes.
But just in terms of, I'm just wondering if that might have to do with it.
Okay, well, let's ask. Hold, so from your inner knowing, is what you've just suggested at all relevant to the reason your body is saying not to move forward? Is there any deception in that? No. Is it something else? Okay, so is it about standing out in some way and being more conspicuous? Okay, is there anything more that needs to be known about that? Okay, so that was just kind of an intuitive awareness that I have. Makes sense to you?
It clicked, yeah.
Okay, so we want to clear that as some kind of a block that's in the way to move forward on this. Whatever that means to you, I don't want to spend time dialoguing with you about the history.
Right.
You're just going to be attuning to it and thinking about it with whatever interventions follow. Okay?
Yeah.
All right. We want to clear that conflict. Hold, so from your inner knowing, is the best intervention to start with stimulating the crown chakra? Okay. So another, I didn't mention that, but from my 20 years of practicing and teaching Kundalini Yoga, somehow I got very attuned to chakras. So working with chakras like this, I can see chakras when I work with people. And so I'll have you start just by stimulating the crown chakra as you're thinking about it. And then if the energy shifts, I'll redirect you to tap on another chakra. So just stay connected to what that was about being conspicuous. Okay, now over the throat chakra. Huh. Okay, so I'm having some inner guidance. And the inner guidance is I should take my rattle and start rattling. But it's always a very dramatic thing to do that. So so I have to ask first. Hold, from your deepest wisdom, from your inner knowing, would it be in your highest good for me to proceed with the rattle as the next intervention? Is there any deception? Yes. Okay. So what that means is that there's something that I might call subtle negative energy, and I was tuning into it at the throat chakra. And so when I pick up the rattle, I'm not just using the rattle as another intervention, but usually what happens is that one of my helping spirits merges with me and directs the rattle. So I become kind of the channel or the vehicle for the rattling. It gets very intense. I hope it doesn't disturb them too much. My next door neighbors. Okay, so your job is still the same thing, to just focus on what it is about being conspicuous that somehow might be an interfering factor with being fully present in your physical body.
what if I can't really think consciously, but I have that energetic feel of what that means?
That's fine.
That's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, as long as you're attuning to it in your own way,
right. Okay.
Staying present with it as best you can. Okay. Think.
It was a lot better. It was a lot more solid than my feet. It was more solid than
that. Well, all I would say is that you had something ugly around your throat,
mm-hmm.
and it's not there anymore. Mm-hmm. So, let's see. Hold from your inner knowing. Let's see, where were we? From your inner knowing. Is there any reason not to move forward on this intention? Okay, is there any deception? Okay, so whatever that issue was about being conspicuous or prominent, have you cleared that, released it 100% at all levels? Great. So do we have permission to move forward now? All right, we do. Now, are there any energetic origins that need to be identified and healed on this intention? Any deception? Is there any remaining interference? Well, a little uncertain there. So let's try again. Hold. Okay, again, hold. So why don't you take a sip of water? I don't know if you found this to be true, but doing this energy psychology work for me is very water depleting. I and my clients have a big jug on the table, and we're always drinking and taking time to go to the bathroom and drinking more. It's even when I do qigong after about 10 minutes, it feels like I need hand lotion on my hands. It's really dry. I get dried out. Okay, tug on your hair. Hold. Need more. something happened in that process.
Howard, do you usually have the client sit? Because I was wondering if she was going to tip over.
Because you were wondering what?
I was wondering if she was going to tip over while she was standing there. It seemed like she started to leave. I was wondering if there's a concern that the client might fall down.
So the question is, do I always have people stand up because the concern is my client was weaving and might have fallen over? And I always have them stand up unless they tell me that they have to sit down because of a physical issue. I've never had anybody fall over yet. And frankly, I wasn't aware of Lynn weaving, but I was in an altered state. So were you aware of moving back and forth?
I wasn't. I have trouble just standing still. You know, that I feel weak at times standing up.
Okay.
I don't feel the same way right now.
Good. Okay. So muscle test, let's try your hydration. Good. Okay. Another tip. If you get muscle testing that is uncertain in the middle, always the best thing to do first, check for hydration. It's the simplest way. Mm-hmm. Hold from your deepest wisdom, from your inner knowing. Is there anything that stands, let's see, do we have permission to move forward? Any deception? Okay, we're gonna have to try your energy again. Hold. Well, it switched your energy, whatever it was. So why don't we do this again? Tapping under the collarbones. So the rattling, whether it was the rattling itself or the energy behind the rattling, disrupted your energetic flow. Mm-hmm. And on some level, it threw you off balance a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's check it again. Hold. Okay, that brought you back to normal. So from your inner knowing, Are there any energetic origins that stand in the way that need to be identified and healed? Any deception? Okay. Any remaining interference? Any deception? So you started off at 50%.
Mm-hmm.
Are you now at least 70% embodied? At least 80%? 90%? Are you now 100% present in your physical body at all levels? Is there any deception? Okay. Do you have any energetic boundaries with your physical body now? Previously, or before we started, did you have any energetic boundaries with your physical body? No. Good. So is there anything that you need to do on a daily or regular basis in order to maintain full embodiment? Would it be an energy psychology intervention or strategy? Okay. Would it be stimulating the solar plexus? Would it be doing the thymus thump? Okay, for at least a minute? At least 2 minutes? At least 3 minutes? Any longer? Yes, at least 4 minutes? Any longer? 4 minutes. Okay, are you to start today? Tomorrow? At least 4 minutes. 4 minutes at least once a day? At least twice a day? 4 minutes twice a day. Any more frequently? 4 minutes twice a day starting tomorrow. Okay. So are you to do this for every day for at least a week? At least 2 weeks? Any longer? At least 3 weeks? Any longer? 3 weeks. Okay. So, are you willing?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So, can you repeat to me what your assignment is?
I'm to do the thymus thump starting tomorrow, at least 4 minutes, for 3 weeks.
Twice a day?
Twice a day. It's a good thing you said that.
Twice a day?
Twice a day.
Okay. Usually, I have a little prescription pad, and I write that down because after something like this, both my client and I tend to be in an altered state. So it seemed to me you were having some feelings coming up.
Mm-hmm.
How are you feeling right now, and what are
grateful.
You noticing?
Just very grateful.
Grateful. You're welcome. Glad to work with you. Okay, so let's see. We're just about out of time, and so just for the test online, What's the best and most accurate method to calibrate the degree of client's dissociation? Muscle testing. In my embodiment protocol, what's necessary to check for and resolve to ensure that the client doesn't create any self-sabotage to restore full embodiment? Psychoenergetic reversal. Check for objections. Okay? What are some specific somatic and psychic symptoms indicating dissociation? Well, as I said before, it can be... Lack of energy, fatigue. They're all written out on your handout. Different symptoms. Actually, one client I was working with was very cold. He came up to me, and because he was having a problem with a director, he was an actor, and his director was yelling at him, yelling at everybody. This is the director's way, and he just couldn't deal with this kind of intensity. He knew that he checked out, was a college student, and he was cold and clammy, so there are lots of different symptoms, somatic, psychic symptoms, forgetting, chronic fatigue, so on. And the last one, in the shamanic paradigm, what might be analogous to dissociation?
Soul
loss. Okay, so for the last minute, any questions? Yes?
When your guidance came in, when you were working with her,
yes.
Did you have a sense of who was there, or doesn't it matter?
No, I didn't know who was there. I just knew that there was something going on in her throat. There was a contraction or a constriction of energy at her throat. So my inner guidance was, you need to get the rattle so that we can direct whatever it is at the throat.
Now, when you go into the lower world and you connect with a power animal, do you then have a sense of what animal it is?
Yeah. Yeah.
So would it be safe to say that the guidance that came in came from the upper world?
Oh, I knew exactly who it was. It was one of my Native American Indians who merges with me to do this rattling every once in a while.
Oh, well, that's what I was asking.
I didn't have to go down or go up. After a while, when
that's
one...
That's what I was asking. Did you know who
yeah.
it was that came in?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah, I knew what helper it was. Okay, you first and then you.
I'm just not clear. Maybe there is no difference between being 100% embodied in your body and the other phrase you used, which was, are you 100% in harmony with your body?
Okay, so... question was, what's the difference between being 100% present in your body and being in harmony or having 100% energetic boundaries with your body? Well, typically, if people are not fully present in their body, they're not going to be in good harmony with their body. They're going to be disconnected from their body. So after being re-embodied, then I ask, do you now have 100% energetic boundaries with your physical body? Are you now in good harmony with your physical body? And that... it follows.
When you say harmony, you mean boundaries.
Yes, yes. Thank you. And you?
It seemed that you did not express, you did not explicitly address any particular traumas.
Any particular what?
Traumas behind the...
That's right.
But was that implicit in the rattling process?
Well, the reason that there were no traumas, the question was I didn't address any specific traumas in that demonstration. And was it implicit in the process? And the reason was, at least the way I work, which tends to accelerate the work, is that when subtle negative energy tends to emerge, as it did with Lynn, kind of quickly, if that's addressed right away, it tends to be a very substantial and pervasive disturbance in what was the trauma. So we never needed to go back in time and go identify what particular specific trauma was responsible for that dissociation, because the subtle negative energy that I saw as this kind of serpentine thing around her neck was creating the dissociation. So I don't need to know. Now, if Lynn were to come back the following time, there might be another reason to go back in time. Maybe she would be dissociated again, or maybe she'll never be dissociated again. I don't know that. But sometimes if there isn't that subtle negative energy that emerges right away, then there's an energetic origin or a specific trauma that we would identify and work in to clear out limiting beliefs or a core affect or a blocked emotion or something like that in a more incremental step-by-step method that you could use with EFT or any energy psychology method, and then reference back to the degree to which the client is back in their body.
So you also, do you see that there's subtle negative energy, there's sometimes some intrusion from outside?
Yes. Yes, I see that subtle negative energy as an intrusion from outside, but I don't know where it came from, and I don't know when it started. I could have asked more questions, but you know, we're kind of running out of time. Walter?
Do you always use this rattle, or do you sometimes use other ways to work?
Do I always use the rattle? No. Sometimes I never use the rattle. That's why I brought my Tibetan bowls and my Tibetan bell. Sometimes it's enough just to chime the Tibetan bell and then have somebody do EFT and then maybe do TAT numbers 5 or 6 to forgive themselves for something that they did, and that's it. So it just so happened that one of my helping guides came in and wanted to reveal how rattle work is done, but that is not always the case.
But do you usually use a vibrational introduction like that?
Yeah, yeah. Question is, do I usually use a vibrational intervention? Yes, I frequently use a Tibetan bowl or a Tibetan bell. My clients love the sound of that, and they always tend to be very effective. So if you're interested in acquiring one, if you don't have one, I would recommend it. But only get a bell or a bowl if it really speaks to you. Don't get one off the internet. Go into a store where they have lots of them and chime them all until one resonates with you and it sounds really great, like it speaks to your heart. And that would be the bell or the bowl to get. And then when you get it home, before you use it with your client, take some sage, find some sage and burn it and smudge it so that any energy that other people have had that have used it, will be cleared. Yes, one last question.
I was just curious why you didn't test to see whether there were additional interventions she might need to use besides the thymus thump.
Oh, because that's all. I don't know why I didn't ask for more. I asked, is there anything you need to do to maintain this? And it was thymus thump. Usually one intervention is sufficient.
Okay.
In my experience, for homework to maintain the state of being in one's body. So I'd love to speak with you more, but our time has elapsed. So thank you all.